Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by SuperValu Insurance, looking out for you and yours with our new life and mortgage protection insurance.
But first this morning, award-winning journalist and longtime Dorky resident Robert Fisk covered the Middle East for more than four decades before his death in 2020. In his last years, he worked on a book called Night of Power, which has just been published by Fourth Estate. In it, he considers the events, the people, and the thinking that have shaped the Middle East. Well, Robert Fisk's wife, Nellyfer Pazira Fisk, worked with him on many of the stories the book recalls, and she joins me now in the studio. Thanks to you so much for being here, Nellyfer.
Thank you.
And so sorry that you lost your Robert. We'll come back to that. But look, we're going to talk about all the ideas in the book. It's a fascinating read, but your own story is fascinating. You were born in India, you're an Afghan, you ended up in Canada. Tell me a little about your own life.
Gosh, I mean, it looks like another lifetime in itself. I am the lucky, fortunate refugee from a landlocked, war-torn country, Afghanistan, to have ended up where I am today, because my father worked with the World Health Organization. That opened up the possibility for us to go to Canada, but I did live in Pakistan as a refugee for over a year. We walked across Afghanistan to smuggling, you know, ways to get to Pakistan because you couldn't get anywhere else on a plane. The war was pretty bad. So I grew up in the war. The sharpest memory in my mind is at age five when my father was taken to prison because he opposed the communist government. And people may forget the history, but my country was also invaded by Russia. It was the predecessor to Putin, which was the Soviet Union. And of course, I spent most of my teenage life being part of a resistance group to try to fight the Russian occupation of Afghanistan, which ended. But unfortunately for Afghanistan, everything since has been nothing but disaster.
Did you become a journalist because you wanted those Afghan stories to be told? Is that one of the reasons, or made the main reason?
It actually was the main reason, because I grew up in a country that was at war. It was an imposed war on us. And I also realized that there was a lot of ignorance in the world. When we came to Canada, I was short of being 18 years of age. I barely spoke English. I learned English at 18. And anywhere I went, people didn't even know where Afghanistan was on the map. And so for me, it was a question of, what do I want to do? One, to provide information, to tell the stories of the people, and how also to talk about the horrors of war itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, where did you meet Robert Fisk or Bob Fisk? Did you call him Bob or Robert?
I called him Robert John, which okay. The word, the last sort of John, J-A, is a kind of addition we use in Persian in Afghanistan, both as a respect and an endearing term. So he always called me Nellyfer John and I called him Robert John. Mm-hmm. But he loved to be called Bob, especially in Ireland. And he also referred to himself as, oh, Mr. Bob will do this and Mr. Bob will do that. He had a great sense of humor. We met in Ottawa in Canada, in the Canadian capital, and I was just finishing university. He was giving a lecture, and the date was 18th of April, 1997.
And did you know much about him before you met him?
Not a lot, no. I mean, look, I grew up in the war, so politics is in my blood. And I was an activist in university, involved in different groups of activism. So we used to bring in speakers and people. I had a lot of catching up to do in Canada because I didn't grow up there. So even catching up with the Western language and culture, because I grew up in a police state, everything of the Russian bloc was open to us, but everything of the Western bloc was forbidden. So I didn't know a lot about him. But once he came and he gave the lecture, it was absolutely mesmerizing. And then the request from the public was they wanted to invite him again to come back. Robert was known then, but not the same way as after September 11th, because he was known, I think, maybe to European and to a segment of populations, but he wasn't as internationally recognized at the time.
Now, you say you met in 97. I think you got married then 12 years later, did you, in 2009?
Yes, we got married, yeah. That is 12 years later, yes. But we met in 97, yeah.
Where did you get married?
So first of all, we were going to get married in 2008. That was the plan. But I was doing a film, and it was just about the time when producers signed off, we got our funding. And I said to him, if we go film now, it will be this fall, or I have to postpone it till next year because of the location. And he said to me, look, sweetheart, we can get married anytime. It's our own private life. But I've seen you work so hard. So you do your film and I come and help you, but you must give me a credit as a handler on the film. So we postponed it by a year. We got married in Baalbek in Lebanon. A lot of people may not know, it's the site of, of course, it was a Roman city. It is where the tallest Roman columns still stand. And he had to go and talk to a lot of politicians inside Lebanon to be able to get us access, because, of course, these areas are controlled by different entities, despite the fact that there is a Lebanese government, because we are going to have a lot of international guests. And we had a mixed marriage in Lebanon. Mixed marriages are banned. People go to Cyprus to get married if they're not from the same religion. Right. So for that reason, he had to do a lot of groundwork. And he literally organized a wedding. So all I had to do was to put a dress on and show up.
But way to go. That's so great. Now, Robert Fisk, as people know, he loved Dorky. So I think you lived mainly between Beirut and Dorky when you were together and before he died. Where is home for you now?
Dorky very much, obviously. I mean, we lived between three different... Well, Beirut was a base for him. Dorky was our retirement home and the place which we escaped the heat and horrors of the Middle East periodically, where we came. I have a garden and we'd be kind of hid in our garden and only met with our friends and neighbors around. But I used to go as well, of course, because my family's all in Canada. I'd spend fair amount, and sometimes Christmases we spend in Canada with my family. But since his death, I have been spending more and more time here in Dorky, and it does feel home. And I always say, when you start a garden anywhere, you put your roots down. Mm. So that's how I view it, yeah.
Now, tell me about publishing this book here. It looks really impressive. It's his last book. What's the significance, Nellyfer, of the title Night of Power?
Robert discusses that in the preface, that he didn't come upon this title by coincidence. He chose it specifically. It is the night where Muslims believe that the Holy Quran was descended or revealed, and it's considered the night of lights. So if people stay up during that night and they spend it in, prayers and by dawn, it is called the night of lights, and so they will be blessed. And the reason why Robert chose this title particularly was that he often referred to that his entire career, he has watched people within the boundaries of what we call the Middle East, burn in hellfire, in wars and dictatorships and torture chambers. And so the question in his mind, which he was saying he did not know the answer to, was that how is it that the Muslim Arab world finds itself being dominated by West militarily, economically and politically? And he often argued that, yes, the people in the Middle East would like to have the Western doctors, technology, information, cultural exchanges, human exchange and understanding of information, but not military bases, not military operations. And so that's why he used the title to ask that question, that where is the light in the Middle East?
In your postscript, you offer a really fascinating detail about his time in the Middle East. The fact he lived in the same rented apartment in Beirut for 44 years, and he did so for a reason. What was it?
In the early days, I said to him, this is a beautiful country. I really do like Lebanon very much, and Beirut is a beautiful city. Should we buy a place? And then he turned to me and said, I come from England, okay, I come from a world that colonized most of these lands and have created the borders of these lands, and including Northern Ireland, obviously, and former Yugoslavia. He said, for that reason, I do not ever wish to purchase any property in this land because it belongs to the people that live here. I am a European. He was never had any illusions about that. He said, I am a European. I believe in Europe, but I don't believe in a colonial mindset. And so as part of that, I will live in Europe happily. We have a home in Ireland, and I would prefer not to buy anything in the lands of people that have suffered so much of conquest and colonization by the West.
And of course, many of us who were lucky enough to interview Bob down the years, he was consistent in his condemnation of Western interference in the Middle East. One thing I found fascinating in the book is both you and Robert, you write about language and how it's used to shape, you know, our perceptions of events and people in the Middle East. How do you think terminology changes depending who or what is being described?
Well, language is very important. I mean, for him, it was important because he was a linguist as well. For me, it's important because I learned English as a foreign language and as an outsider. Words all carry meanings and perceptions. And our criticism, which was a combined criticism of the media, the mainstream media in the West, is that how, because they're the kind of correlations that have come about in the last decades between journalists and politicians, you have to hold politicians to account. So in that case, you should not adapt the language that they use. Because, of course, all the politicians would like to do, it's part of their job, is to try to conceal certain truths. And none of them would like to be exposed or expose anything that will endanger their chances of re-elections and the rest of it. But it's the job of the media and the reporters to question those things, and including the use of the language the politicians use. So, for example, one of the things that Robert often used, and I would just mention this, of course, as well in the book, is that how the language has been skewed to make it very confusing for the public to understand, from the use of the word of settlement to colony or neighborhoods. In most of North American media, they refer to settlements in West Bank, for instance, as neighborhoods. Neighborhoods are peaceful places where a dispute is between two neighbors over a fence. But in fact, what is happening in reality in West Bank is it's disputed land between the two parties, and they are not equal. One is taking over the land from the dispossessing the people. So you cannot use the same word. And even settlement is sort of a question in our minds that, is it much more neutral? So therefore, when you hear someone talking about it, you don't think there's much wrong with it, you know? So this is why the language is so
important.
Words
matter. Now, Robert, he had both Israeli and Palestinian friends, many of them. Lord knows what he thinks what's happening now, but did he see any prospect, do you think, of long-term peace between Jews and Arabs?
Yes. Robert and I used to talk a lot. I mean, look, it was our daily conversation, things that people hear on the news now. For us, it was everyday conversation. And he often said that someone asked him, do you have any hope? And he said, well, I must have some sense of optimism and hope for peace. Otherwise, I will pack and go. Why would I be writing about all this? Our view was that the entity that will bring about the possibility of peace was not going to be the American politicians. It would be the Jewish community in diaspora, the Jewish community inside Israel, who would realize that they have the right to the state, to proper state of Israel, but occupation must end. And I actually, looking at the current war, I mean, there is the immediate of unfolding of atrocities, which is horrible. But when you think beyond that, okay, I look now and I see the struggle of the Jewish community, whether in diaspora or whether they're inside Israel. And that must be applauded, because what they're trying to do is to say, look, we cannot continue with this status quo. And we must now have to re-examine that what kind of a country we want to live in as Israelis, because you can have all the land, but you need the peace to actually live in that land.
Now, sadly, Bob died in October 2020 during COVID, of course, and all those restrictions. Did that make everything so much more difficult for you at that time?
Absolutely. I mean, look, he didn't die from COVID. So obviously I was allowed to be able to see him and hold his hand and, you know, visit when he was in the hospital. And I also feel terrible for families of those people who were COVID patients, and majority of times they were not even allowed to be there with their loved ones. But of course, it really did compound it, you know, the difficulty that my family could not travel to be with me. The fact that, I mean, I'm grateful for my neighbors and friends in Ireland, but I was on my own. And, you know, the immediate thing for us as human beings is you just hope for a human touch at the moment when you're going through such a trauma. Mm. And that could not happen because of the fear of COVID and the transmission. So it did make it a lot more difficult.
How are you now?
Seeing the book has been an incredible, a sense of stability in some ways. It has not been an easy, you know, few years since Robert's death. It will not get any easier either. I'm not delusional to think that you can recover from a grief. It's, you know, we get used to living with a life as it is. But finishing his book and seeing it out became a single purpose in my mind that actually sustained me and got me going through the difficulties. Now, it may sound a bit odd because a lot of people would like to close things off and go and do other things and find distractions. And I was often told it's best if I go away and have distractions. But going into working on Robert's book was going through the hell of that grief. But I'm glad I did it. And now seeing the book being out, because his words resonate. His analyses were important regardless, but sadly, with what is going on right now around the world, not just in the Middle East, but also in Ukraine and you know, the rest of the, and Lebanon as well, I think that his words are just so much more relevant, and this book has all of a sudden become so much more important. In a way, it would have been important before, but it has become even more important because of the analysis that he offers, because it almost reads like part of the chapters, and I'd love to know what you think, but I felt when I was doing the proofreads that some of the chapters reads as if he's there on the ground reporting today's atrocities. That's how prescient it is. Mm. And the second thing, which he wrote about in his preface, the theme of the book is normalization of this latest warfare, which he described as the latest warfare since September 11th, has been that the Western nations have been dismissive of international laws. And this new kind of a warfare that has unfolded has deleted the protection of the civilians. And he, in a very prophetic way, warns that this is a very dangerous precedent that's been set since 9/11, with the American going to Afghanistan, bombing villages, and then going and invading Iraq, and again killing civilians with impunity, without any kinds of questioning, because Americans refused to be part of the ICC, the International Criminal Court, and refusal to accept that those laws of war should apply to them.
Well, Nellifer, thank you so much for coming into studio this morning. I'm so sorry you lost your husband, Robert Fisk, but the book you have managed to help get published is his final book. It's called Night of Power, The Betrayal of the Middle East by Robert Fisk, and it's published by Fourth Estate. Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me.